This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When she wasn't driving a county school bus, Iris Carlton Lene was stacking tobacco and raising hogs on her family's farm. But her primary goal was always clear. No matter what else, Iris was going to have to get a scholarship and go to college. And she did. And her education was only the beginning. Eventually, she received her Ph.D. and spent the last 40-plus years in academia teaching social work students how to better serve communities like the one she grew up in. Iris is the Berg Beach Distinguished Professor of Community Social Work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She was named Social Worker of the Year by the North Carolina chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. And Iris Carlton Lene is here with me right now. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
You grew up, appropriately enough, in a town called Carlton Town.
Yeah.
Tell us where that is and what it was like.
Carlton Town, southeastern North Carolina. It's 6 miles from Warsaw, 6 miles from Magnolia, 8 miles from Clinton, in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. So Carlton Town because my father, his brothers, and their first cousins owned the land in that community. And I always say they married these child brides, these 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old women, and brought them into that community. And we grew up with all those folk.
So a large extended family right there.
Absolutely.
And you were a farmer. You grew up on a farm, right?
Tobacco farm.
So tell us about what you did.
Ooh. Growing up on a tobacco farm. So I always say, growing up on a tobacco farm will make you go to college. So it's interesting because I did a little research on tobacco farming in the bright tobacco area of southeastern North Carolina. And so the scholarship, so as I read about it, the literature refers to tobacco farming as labor intensive. And I think that is so cute because, you know, the way I would describe it is something that you really can't say in polite company, but I would certainly not call it, you know, labor intensive. It's like, I have to go. This is the hardest work I've ever done in my life.
Well, you can understand then why that phrase in the brochure anyway. But there's also, a lot of hard work. And obviously, as you say, nothing can speak to the need for college education than growing up on a tobacco farm. On the other hand, I get the sense that there was a profound sense of community.
Absolutely.
That would be something that would be very attractive about that life.
That was attractive about it. Growing up around people who you knew loved you, wanted the best for you. And pretty much shared the same values. So all the households pretty much had the same values. And in my community, going to college was seen as my parents always said, we don't want you to have to work as hard as we did. So being educated would mean not having to do that. But also, a college education was seen as something that couldn't be taken from you. And these were people who'd had lots of things taken from them. And so they saw this, if you get this, this is not only your ticket out, but it's something that you can always have. And so everybody talked to us about going to college. I could go to visit my uncle down the road and his wife would talk about the importance of going to college, as she said, so that you can measure arms with anybody. And, you know, then I could go across the road to my other cousin and their kids might be home from college for the weekend. And so it was, this is what you have to do when you grow up out there. It's like, there's no question about it. We had to go to college.
But it's interesting when you say that, because if you talk about what it would have taken for African-American families to own land down there and keep it, you talked about the things that they lost, and maybe we can get to that for a second. Mm-hmm. These are extremely resourceful people who could have rested on that accomplishment, look at what we've done, but recognize that there's no keeping this unless you keep moving forward.
They were indeed resourceful. I was amazed at how resourceful they were. They could make things out of nothing. They could problem solve in ways that I could only imagine. But the land was always so important to them. And land ownership was important. And they taught us that land ownership is valuable. My father said they ain't making no more land. So it's like, if you have this, you hold on to this, because if you lose it, and that's part of what the multiple losses were that these farmers experienced. They experienced people manipulating to take their land. My father, so poor African-American farmers acquired small parcels of land. So it wasn't like, I'll buy this 400-acre farm. It's like, I'll buy this acre and a half over here, over here, and over here. So the land was in disparate places.
Right.
But my father always talked about it as the last land acquisition was the new ground. So it might have been purchased 30 years ago, but because it was the last purchase, it was the new ground. So we were socialized to value it, to value the land, and to keep it.
It's interesting to me to imagine all that, because, again, that tie to the ground, all that you did to get it, and understand that the best thing you could do for your kids is ask them to leave it. I mean, it seems to me a hard thing for a parent to do to work that. What kind of education did your parents have?
My father, I think, finished third grade, and my mother finished 11th grade.
Mm.
I was always so perplexed as to how these people knew things. They were smart people. I don't know how they knew things. You know, they weren't widely read. They didn't go anywhere because the cars couldn't get them, but, you know, 6 or 8 miles away from home. And the only magazine that came into our house was the Progressive Farmer. And I think that came with the Farm Bureau membership or something.
Mm.
So, but these old people were really smart. And I was smart enough to know that they were smarter than I was.
Even that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because, again, talk about attention. You're trying to get out of there. Yeah. So you may not want to listen to these folks.
No, they were smarter than me. I knew that then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, I understand you always were the one who wanted to sit around and listen.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I was always the social worker. So, yeah, I was the one sitting around listening to their stories and, you know, their joys, but also the things that were sorrowful for them. And I could tell one from the other just by their body language or the way they ended conversations. And when something was difficult, the women were the talkers. When something was difficult for them, they would just, you know, the conversation would kind of die down a bit, and then they would say, well, we'll just leave that in the hands of the Lord. So that I knew that was the end of that one, so they would go to something different. Mm-hmm. But listening to them helped me to understand a lot of things, like values, to understand what people in my community valued, what they all expected of us.
You had four siblings, right? Or were one of four?
I have four siblings.
Four siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And all of you, the same expectations around each of you, I think.
They were, but I had two older brothers. My oldest brother was 20 years my senior, and then I had a brother who was 17 years older. And then my parents took a break, sort of, for about, 14 years.
Uh-huh.
And then they had three children, and I'm among three youngest kids.
Yeah.
So I really grew up with three father figures, daddy, the real father, and then these two brothers who were really adults when we were born. And my oldest, one of the oldest brothers, the one who was 17 years old, passed away a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. That was so painful because that was the end of daddy. We didn't have any. And while those guys lived a very different lifestyle from the three younger kids, they had to work much harder than we did. But they were always there for us. You know, they helped our parents to raise the three younger kids. I want to get back to the college thing. But we had a ritual in winter of having to take castor oil. I hope you've never experienced that. That was difficult. So my oldest brother would always come out to my parents' home on Saturday morning when my mother would be giving us this castor oil, and his job was to hold us down or to otherwise help her to get that castor oil in us. But that was part of his role, to help mom and daddy to raise those three younger kids. Of the five of us, four of us went to North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro.
Yeah.
three of us graduated. My oldest brother did not attend. And sadly, he grew up in a time where he didn't have the people around him to encourage mm-hmm. him and to help him to understand that it was a possibility mm-hmm. for him. So, but his role was to make certain that we got to Greensboro. So, because he had the car that worked. And so his role was to take us on move-in day. If we were in the homecoming parade, his role was to be there and to make certain that our parents were there. And his role was to take them to graduation. And so we eventually understood that while he did not matriculate at North Carolina A&T, that he was indeed an Aggie. So we just made him an honorary Aggie. So we bought him sweatshirts and T-shirts, and so he could walk around being an Aggie like the rest of us.
I am talking today on The State of Things to Iris Carlton Lene, who is the Berg Beach Distinguished Professor of Community Social Work at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, named Social Worker of the Year by the North Carolina Chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. And our conversation will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Iris Carlton Lene knew education was important, but wasn't sure how she was going to make her mark. Then she figured out how to spend more than 40 years on the other side of a desk as a professor, but inspiring a new generation of those who will go out and serve the community as a social worker. She is indeed Social Worker of the Year for the state of North Carolina. We talked about going to North Carolina A&T in college, but you, in high school, you were driving a school bus, right?
I was.
Were you old enough to drive? You were 16.
16. I was mm-hmm. old enough. Yep. I got my driver's license at age 16, and I got my bus license at age 16. And so the process of getting a bus license was a quick and dirty one. You just go down to Kenansville, which is where the bus garage was, yeah. and there were probably six of us and the instructor, and we would take turns driving. And that was how we learned to drive the bus. So, as you know, I sat down to drive the bus, and there were no automatic transmissions.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to shift, and so I began to drive, and the instructor said, "Oh, I see you've been driving a truck." And I said, "No, sir, I've been driving a tractor." And so that's a real difference when you're talking about maneuverability. But it was driving the school bus was a good experience.
Why? What'd you learn?
Well, you learn that a lot of people depend on you, so you have to be dependable. You kind of have to kind of walk the straight and narrow. You have to do that to get the bus because the principal decides who gets the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, girls were more likely to get buses than boys because we were perceived to be more cautious and, you know, going to abide by the rules and stuff. But the buses had governors on them. They didn't go but 35. There wasn't too much you could do.
Still, a 16-year-old boy could figure out a way, couldn't he?
I actually did try to figure out how to get that governor off, but okay. But I failed. But, yeah, I drove 124. Actually, the three youngest kids all drove 124.
Was that the bus number?
That was the bus number.
Okay.
We all drove the same 124. And my older brothers also drove buses.
Mm.
And because that was the only way we could make extra money was driving buses. Mm. And I remember the five of us were talking, and we were talking about bus driving and that experience. And so then we started talking about when the bus broke down that we had to call Pee-wee. And so the three youngest kids, you know, we knew Pee-wee was the mechanic. He was the mechanic for the entire county. And then my older brothers, 20 and 17 years older than me, said, "Yeah, Pee-wee would come right away." And we were going, "Oh, no, it wasn't the same."
How old is Pee-wee?
That's what we were wondering. How old is this man? But it was the same bus mechanic for all of us.
Wow, great stuff. So mm-hmm. you did made some money, learned a little bit about responsibility, and then went to North Carolina A&T.
Right.
Why did you choose to go there? Were you looking at other schools?
I did. I actually applied to Fayetteville State University. That was the first and only place I applied. And I was accepted there, and I was so excited because I'd never been accepted to college before. So I showed my father the letter, and I said, "Daddy, I've been accepted, and, you know, I'm excited." And my father, who was a man of very few words, looks at me and goes, "Well, that's nice, sister." And then he said, but I don't see why you can't go to A&T like the rest of them. And I thought, I never knew he wanted me to go to A&T. I thought I was pretty clear on where, you know, college, but he never specified. But so anyway, the next day I went and applied and went to A&T. And I understood later that he really wanted, like the rest of them meant, that there was somebody to protect me. There was somebody to watch over me when he and my mother couldn't. So my first cousin was on the faculty in the School of Nursing, and my sister was a senior. And so for him, being at A&T meant that these two women were going to make certain that I was okay.
When did you figure that out?
Not as a 19-year-old.
Yeah,
it was just a little later when all of that became clear for me.
Interesting time to be going to school, too, and an interesting moment in history.
It was.
Especially to be at a place like A&T.
It was.
Tell us about
that. It was a pretty interesting time. My first year.
So give us the year. What year are we talking about?
We're talking about 68, 69. Yeah. So now everybody knows how old I am.
Well, I'm sorry to do that,
but that's okay.
We put everything in context.
That's
here.
Right, it's okay.
A public radio thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So 68, 69. So 69, the spring semester, there was a, quote, riot on campus. Uh-huh. Governor Scott sent in the guards uh-huh. with tanks and guardsmen and one of my classmates was murdered on campus, Willie Grimes, and that case is still open, so nobody's ever been convicted of his murder. It was a scary time. The president of the university closed school. He, you know, within a few hours after Grimes was murdered and the guards entered the campus, he said, school is closed, you have 8 hours to leave. You have to be off campus by whatever time the next day, and it was amazing to see how quickly I was in the bowl, and that's where the first year mm-hmm. female residence halls were, and you know, within hours, the bowl was filled with all these cars from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, yeah. up and down the East Coast, because people had been keeping up with what was going on the campus. I had probably about a dollar. And so I had to figure out how, my sister and I were trying to figure out how we're going to get home, you know, how much of our things we're going to be able to take with us. And so we figured it out. We were going to get a ride with a colleague to Fayetteville. Then we were going to get somehow from Fayetteville to Warsaw. So we knew we could get someplace. And people were helping each other. So then my cousin comes over. She's the one who's the professor in the College of Nursing. And she said, okay, you're going with me. And I said, no, we figured this out. This is what we're going to do. And she said, no. Auntie said, you go with me. So I knew that my parents had called her and said, go get those girls. That was her role. So she was there for us to pack all our stuff that we could get in her car. And she took us off campus. We spent the night with her until she could get us home.
So there it is again, that family and community.
That's
all
right.
Just watching, whether even when you're not thinking about
That's
it.
That's right.
They're always got you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your decision to go into social work.
I wasn't certain what I would major in when I went to college. Which is always a bad thing. But so I talked with my sister and my first cousin in School of Nursing, and they both decided that I probably should think about social work. And I don't know why they made that decision. They are not able to articulate that now as to why they told me that. But they also knew that we had a really strong social work program on campus. And I think they both saw in me that person who's paying attention, who has some degree of compassion and a need to intervene. And so they said, go talk with the chair of the social work department. And I did, and that was Will Scott. And I talked with Will, and I told him that I was not certain what I would major in. And so he asked questions of and began to understand who I was. And he said, I think you'll probably do well here. So I took a social work course and thought, I like this. This makes sense for me. I'm not sure why it made sense for me, but it felt right. And as a 19, 20-year-old, I wasn't that good at explaining or even understanding why it felt right. But it did. And Will really remained my mentor until his death, really. Wow. He was a very strong personality, and he knew that most of us were poor kids from rural communities. And so part of his strategy was to build self-esteem and to help us to understand possibilities.
How would he do that?
Well, he reinforced what we knew and reinforced our intellectual capacity. He essentially helped us to know we were bright kids. We knew that we were okay, but he helped us to understand that we were really very bright kids. And so my undergraduate social work program was really designed to prepare us for graduate school, not to be social workers with a bachelor's degree, because he understood, although we didn't, that we would be competing for those positions with people who had degrees in music and art and history and no degrees at all.
Yeah.
So graduate school was our next step. Probably 75% of my graduating class went into some graduate program. A colleague, William Dudley, went to law school. Another colleague went to a library of science master's program. But most of us went into social work programs. And we went to the best schools in the country. Will had relationships with people at those universities and was often a consultant at those universities. And because he knew us well, he was a pushy person. And so he would say, Iris, I think you should go to Michigan or Chicago. And, I wasn't sure I wanted to live in those states. So I thought, well, what about UNC Chapel Hill? And he said, no, that's not the best program for you. I want you to go to one of the top three programs in the country. And so he told me what they were, and I completed my applications for those programs. So I was accepted at Washington University in St. Louis and the University of Chicago. Washington University didn't give me very much money, and I had to have funding. University of Chicago was more forthcoming, so I went to University of Chicago. And although I had a bachelor's degree in social work, I still did the two-year program rather than an advanced standing program. With a bachelor's degree, I could have done a one-year, one calendar year program, but I did the two-year program at the University of Chicago.
I wonder what that felt like at the moment when somebody says almost parenthetically, no, you need to go to, sort of one of the top three. I'm going to send you here. You had not considered, had you considered yourself top three material?
Oh, no.
I mean, here's a guy who apparently, in the way he sort of says it, has had you in the top three all the entire
scary
time.
Scary as hell.
Yeah.
It was really terrifying. Although I always knew that I was bright, I never thought of myself as like bright, like really excellent. You know, I knew I could learn and blah, blah. But again, Will steps in with his, you can do anything, you are excellent. And so you buy that to some extent. And University of Chicago was a great program. And there I understood the quality of my BSW program. Once I began to take classes, that's when I understood, I know this stuff. I know how to do this. I've been doing this for 2.5 years in my BSW program. And, of course, many of my colleagues at U of C had not. They weren't didn't have social work backgrounds. So I understood pretty quickly that, this is where I should be, and I can do this.
And you were well prepared for it.
And I can do this, absolutely.
PhD program in Maryland and pursued a somewhat unusual research project at Maryland. Tell us about
that. It was. So here's Will intervenes again. So when I graduated with my master's in social work, I worked for a year as a public health social worker in Chicago. And so Will called me one Sunday and said, how would you like to teach at A&T? And I said, Millette, I think I'd like to do that. He said, can you be here in 2 weeks? I said, I'll be there in a week. So I left Chicago and I taught at A&T for 3 years. But for Will, he understood probably better than I did that I need to get a PhD. So he was, from the time he hired me, for the 3 years that I taught there, he was on my back. You have to go into a PhD program. Have you applied? Have you thought about this one? And no. So, and of course, being in the academy, I also understood that I did need a doctorate. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to expect to be a university professor without doing that. So, So I went to University of Maryland, Baltimore. Again, the same kind of trepidation, like, I wonder, can I do a PhD? Although my sister had a PhD from Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, but my sister's smarter than I am. So I'm going, well, she can do it, but that doesn't mean I can do this. But the University of Maryland, it was really a very good experience. I had co-chairs of my doctoral committee, Michael Reich and Paul Efros. They were wonderful, and they said, you can do your research on anything that you want to do it on. So I said, well, I think I'd like to do a historical dissertation. And they didn't say, this is a really bad idea and you won't be marketable. Although it might have not been the greatest idea, and you know, being marketable did play into it. But Michael, they were co-chairs, and Michael did have a PhD in history, although they both had master's degrees in social work.
Well, tell us about the topic in the particulars.
Okay, I did a dissertation on George Edmund Haynes, who was co-founder of the National Urban League. Right. And so then I learned that the Urban League was a social work organization. And although I'd heard of it, I'd never thought of it as a social work organization. So anyway, I did this historical dissertation. I learned so much about my profession and just about the issues and problems from a historical perspective. It helped me really to understand what structural inequality is. It sharpened my critical thinking skills, my analytical skills. I really enjoyed doing my dissertation. Now, that's unusual when I say that to people. I liked my doctoral program and enjoyed my dissertation. And I had a lot of support at the University of Maryland at Baltimore. I think I was Michael's first doctoral student. So it was a good idea for me to be successful so that he would have a success with his first doctoral student.
But it's interesting. Forgive me for interrupting this, but I want to ask you about this because it's interesting to me that you're hearing and starting to see questions of structural inequality, the role of the Urban League, the way it did social work, and understanding all this. Your PhD program, had any of this been part of your education up until then?
Not really a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot. I remember when I was at the University of Chicago, and my professors kept talking about these female-headed families, these single-parent families in the African-American community, and it rolled off their tongues like this is such a natural, normal thing. We all know this is a problem and an issue. And I was so confused because I didn't know those families that they were talking about. All the families that I knew, the fathers and mothers were in the house and they raised the kids. And many of them were multi-generational households. The grandparents also lived there. So to get, to enter this master's program and hear the people that I knew talked about in a way that was purely pathological was so confusing to me because that was not my lived experience. And so I think that's when I begin to think, oh, this scholarship doesn't include everybody. It's just talking about some people, but it's not talking about the people I know. So there's another reality that isn't here. And I think it was the doctoral program that allowed me to look for that different reality. Not so much the MSW program.
Mm-hmm.
But the doctoral program.
And come up with a very different approach in understanding that strengths and resilience and the power that people bring to the table.
Absolutely.
Who may need social services mm-hmm. is perhaps where the focus should be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tell you what, I want to take a break here and talk much more about that. When my conversation with Iris Carlton Linnae continues, the Berg Beach Distinguished Professor of Community Social Work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, named Social Worker of the Year by the North Carolina chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, and our conversation continues after this. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Many social work students want to change people's lives. Iris Carlton Linnae has spent a career changing theirs, but she encourages them to look bigger, beyond the individual, to the very systems that keep communities like the one she grew up in misunderstood and very often underserved. Iris is the Berg Beach Distinguished Professor of Community Social Work at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Also this year's winner of Social Worker of the Year, an award from the North Carolina chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. So we left you at the University of Maryland, where you got your PhD, your dissertation on George Edmund Haynes, co-founder mm-hmm. of the Urban League, opened your eyes to a lot. And then you went on to do more research, researched several topics that focused on rural communities. Tell us about your research after that.
So I did some research with elder African-American women in North Carolina. Actually, I really wanted to have an opportunity to talk to my mother and her sister women friends and to get a sense of what they thought of themselves. I knew what I thought of them. I knew that they were probably some of the most powerful people I'd ever met. And problem solvers and warm and compassionate, and they were also ignored and minimized, and I thought their voices should be heard. So I decided I would interview them and talk with them about their strengths and joys and problems and issues. It's really kind of hard to talk with elder African Americans about problems and issues, because they don't go there. They see things as issues to be dealt with and tackled and handled,
mm-hmm.
and prayer as the solution to lots of things. So when I would ask them about problems, they weren't able to talk in those terms. So I had to figure out other ways to get them to tell me about their lives. So it was open-ended interviews. They were delightful. These were women who knew me, who'd always known me. Like one of the women said, "I remember when your mother was carrying you." So that gives a researcher a slightly, just a pause, a slightly different way of thinking about the work they're doing.
Well, and the strategy. I mean, it seems to me as you say this, you have to be ingenious at asking the question. You can't ask somebody, what are your strengths and weaknesses?
That's
not going to yield very much, particularly when they've spent their lives shielding you from that. I mean, it was their job never to show you how hard it was, because they needed to get you up and out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had to start thinking about how tough it was for them, you might just make the mistake of coming back and helping them. I'm talking about from their point of view, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how do you open? What kind of questions do you ask in that case when you're talking not only the people who remember when she carried you, but the woman who carried you?
So I asked them about the land, because I knew their relationship to the land. And so they would point out properties that their fathers owned or their uncle owned, and they would talk about it relative to the land that my father owned. I knew the importance of faith to these women, so we would talk about those things and their roles in the churches and their roles in these secret societies like the Eastern Star and the Grand United Order of Salem and these sisterhoods to which they belong. So I could talk about those things because I knew those things were part of their lives. And so once I could talk about those things, then I could talk about some other things that were a little harder. And because they knew me and felt comfortable that I wouldn't violate them,
right,
and then they would tell me things that they call family secrets. And of course, they weren't secrets because I grew up down there and I knew all that. But they would tell me these things, and then they would end it by saying, "Well, now you know how much of this to use, don't you?" Because, but they trusted me. with the, with their stories and their secrets.
Part, I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the genius is knowing how much of that, how much of the story to tell and mm-hmm. how much to hold back, because mm-hmm. so much is at stake.
That's right.
Right. So that's part of their genius. But what did you learn? Because you said you already knew how smart they were. You had already figured out how ingenious they were. What more did you learn from those interviews?
Not sure how much more I learned, but what it gave me an opportunity to say to other people, this is who these people are, and they do have needs, unmet needs, and the way to begin to address them is to first know who they are. And if you know them and you know how they function, then you know the way to set up services and programs that'll benefit them that they'll use. But if you don't know who they are, then you assume that whatever service works for the larger population will work for them, and it won't. So then you'll be able to say, well, they just want to avail themselves of these programs, when you haven't identified a service or program that they feel reflects them. And so I think that one of the important things about that research was to say to people who would look at it is, you can do survey research. You can have an exceptionally large N, but unless you talk with these individuals and you understand what their lives have been like, then you don't have very much information. Because these people, they know how to complete a survey, and they'll answer yes and five and four and on the Likert scale. They can do that, but you won't have anything. You won't have what you need to really serve them. And sometimes I fear that social work in the academy can get caught up in that, because that's fundable. And we have to be funded. And so sometimes we're not as attentive to the specifics about how people order their lives as I would like to see us.
But let me ask you this, because not only is it fundable, it's also quicker. Right?
Yeah, it is quicker.
And therefore cheaper. So it's fundable on the one side. So there's a revenue stream, and then there's the cutting cost sides on the other side. So for anybody who sees social work as a business, it's very attractive. What do you tell students who simply don't? It sounds to me like your process takes a lot of time.
It does take a lot of time. And it's really not the way that we teach students to think about research. We want students to interpret the data and have all of this in mind, but they can't because they don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. They don't. So sometimes the data may get misinterpreted.
Right. Is it a fundamentally different kind of research that you're calling for, that you would like to see more of?
I think I'd like to see both. I'd like to see research continue that is quantitative, yeah, primarily, yeah, mixed method, yeah, but qualitative as well. I'd like to see us do that, especially with populations like the elderly, those individuals that we know are not going to give us the information that we need to do our jobs in a quick and dirty way, mm-hmm, that we need to take a little bit more time with them than that.
What about on the ground for social workers beyond the research, who take that research and have huge caseloads? It sounds to me, too, like they like to get a deeper understanding and to provide better service and better advice, mm-hmm, you need to take more time than perhaps the average social worker has.
Yeah, I think that you're right, than the average social worker has, because in many instances, and I'll just use the elderly again as an example, when we talk about the importance of relationships, well, you can't build it with one or two interviews. It'll take a little bit longer. And it's the relationships that'll tell you the next steps to make. But if you can't develop them, then you're going to make the next step anyway, and the chances are it might not be the right one. And if it's not the right one, then you risk alienating those people, and they won't work with you. They'll just tell you some things they think you want to hear, so you'll go on and leave them alone. but you won't have what you need to best serve them. And that's one of the unfortunate things about some of our agencies and organizations. They have to put time limits on. You have 2 visits with this person. You don't have 6. You don't have, you have 2. And I think about my own parents. When my father was ill, he had he came home from the hospital with a Foley catheter. It was very confusing to them because you don't leave the hospital with things hanging from your body. And but because he was discharged from the hospital, he also had home health ordered. So there was a home health nurse and a home health aide. My parents didn't know what to do with these people coming into their homes to help them because they'd never been accustomed to receiving help from anyone except their children. But I remember one of the instances in which the home health aide came, and my mother would always clean up for her and, you know, make certain everything was in order. And as she said, you can't have people coming into your house with looking any kind of way. And I kept saying, she's coming into your house to do these things. And if you've done them before she gets there, she doesn't have anything to do. So my mother said she would just come in and look at television. I said, it's because you've done everything. But one day she came, and each day that she came, my mother would always offer her breakfast. But the one day that she came, my father was outside because the nurse had tied the catheter thing to his leg. So he was then mobile. It was no longer hanging on the IV pole, so he was mobile. And so for him, that meant time to farm. So he was outside, you know, with buckets of feed, trying to take them to feed the animals. And the nursing, the home health aide, saw him when she pulls into the yard. She sees this anorexic old guy with these buckets of feed, and she runs over and helps him. And she says, Mr. Carlton, where are you going? He tells her, and she said, I'll go with you. So she gets in the truck, and she goes with him, and she helps him feed up. So when she comes back, my mother offers her breakfast, and she takes it. So it was at that point mm-hmm. that she became someone else to them. But she had, and she was the nursing assistant was an older woman mm-hmm. who understood these people because these were people these were her family members, essentially. So she understood how to help. She understood how to get them to accept her help. And so when I talk with students, I try to help them to understand mm-hmm. that just because we present ourselves as these professional helpers doesn't mean that people want to receive our help because we don't always have a history of being the genuine, reliable helpers that we present ourselves to be, and because we're strangers and we haven't told people that they should trust us.
Can you do that as a professional? Can you professionalize that kind of intimacy that you're talking about, a sense of knowing a community, maybe if you're not from that community?
I think you can, but it takes time. I think we have to learn the people that we serve if we're going to serve them. And communities have cultures and have identities and have quirks and have power brokers and have whomever. And I think we have to learn who those people are if we're going to serve those communities.
This would be particularly challenging, it seems to me, if you talk about the kind of literature that you say you were exposed to when you went to the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
If it's all one story, one narrative that's told over and over from one perspective, it's pretty hard to get a more nuanced understanding.
It is. And so I encourage students to always have that lens that asks why, that, you know, when you read something, when you read a scholarly article, then ask, who are they really talking about? Who's included here? But the best question is, who is excluded? Whose voice isn't heard? And so you as the professional, become that voice. And I think we have to say, well, they're talking about this group of people, but they've left out this population. And what's often left out in terms of strengths-based practice is Black and brown people. And we have to say, were any Black and brown people included in this study? And it's not enough to say, we didn't include too many Black and brown people in this study. That's not enough to validate the results.
How are things going, would you say, in the field of social work? How have things changed in the 40-plus years you've been teaching?
Well, you know, change is gradual and incremental. So we're making efforts to be more responsive. We have to check ourselves every day to make certain that we are indeed being responsive. It's easy to do what we've always done. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult to introduce that other element that'll make your job harder and take more time. And you're not really sure if it'll make a difference ultimately. And so sometimes we do what's expedient. But I think our students, we have some really, really bright students mm-hmm. who are committed to social justice and anti-oppressive work. And I think all social workers are committed to social justice and anti-oppressive work. It's just that some of us do it with much more intentionality than others. But we can't even do a bad job at social work without some commitment to social justice and anti-oppressive work.
How do you stay committed? Because it seems to me that, you know, it's a mixed bag if you try to measure the change over that period of time, and it would be easy to be frustrated and burned out by now. How do you stay passionate?
I'm not sure what the answer is, but if I lose hope and passion, then I can't keep doing. I have to do something else. And so I make certain that I'm around people who share that commitment and compassion and who really believe in advocacy for social justice. And I make sure I surround myself with those people whenever possible. And again, we have some great students who are really bright. And as I think about our students, I'm always thinking about the next social work student that I want to have my back when I need a social worker.
Iris Carlton-Lene, the Berg Beach Distinguished Professor of Community Social Work at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and 2018 winner of the Social Worker of the Year from the North Carolina chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. What a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brookland, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director with Jeff Hamlin on the board today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.